The year is 1993. You're at home having a normal day, cleaning, cooking, doing the usual. But then you hear on the news.
A fierce gun battle has led to a standoff between law officers and occult members of a religious compound outside of Waco this evening.
You ask yourself, what is going on? Just 2 days before, someone had bombed the World Trade Center building, and now this. You continue on with your day, your weeks, but the siege carries on, day after day. 51 days to be exact. On the 51st day, chaos ensues, and you have trouble making out the news. 76 people are dead inside the building that had erupted in flames. Only 9 people escaped the fire, the others just stayed to die to be faithful to their leader, the so-called Second Coming of Christ, David Koresh. But was the man they were willing to die for a true Messiah, or just an abusive pedophile who was a false prophet? Well, that's for you to decide. In this episode, I will cover the seemingly never-ending standoff that has left a lasting impact on generations forward. I'm your host, Rachel Payton, and this is the Chronicles of Time. Let's dive in to the Waco Siege. Begin telling the story of Waco, we must begin in the year of 1959, when Bonnie, then 14 years old, gave birth to a son named Vernon Wayne Howe. The father was Bobby Howe, a high school senior who decided not to raise the child. This led Bonnie to drop out of school in the 8th grade. She would eventually marry, but her new husband would allegedly abuse Vernon. The boy would then move in with his grandmother until his mother would remarry again. It would seem the troubles didn't stop there, because he would fail the first grade twice, causing him to be placed in special education classes. He also suffered from a stutter, and the kids at school would bully him ruthlessly. But at just 12 years old, Vernon's lifelong passion for religion began. He was gifted a radio and would listen to preachers give sermons for hours. He soon began reciting them, tremendously improving his stutter. He and his grandmother shared a close bond from childhood when he lived with her, and he began attending church with her as a teenager. They went to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, where they believed in a vengeful God. This appealed to young Vernon. Following in his mother's footsteps, he too would drop out of school. This was during his freshman year. He decided to give his hand at carpentry. During these years, Howe, 18 by now, got a 16-year-old pregnant. He would never meet the child due to the mother moving away, but this was just the beginning of his obsession with underage girls. By 20 years old, he would be kicked out of the Seventh-day Church due to asking if he could marry the preacher's underage daughter. At this point in his life, Howe attempted to make it in L.A. as a rock star, but simply didn't cut it. Lost and looking for a place to belong, he went about 10 miles out of Waco, Texas. It was the early 1980s when Vernon Howe moved. To the Mount Carmel Center, a sect of the Seventh-day Church that were called the Branch Davidians. Widow Lois Roden was their leader, and the 23-year-old Howe was quite taken by the 67-year-old prophet. People even said he would follow her around like a lost puppy. Soon, the two were in an intimate relationship. At one point, Lois claims to have gotten pregnant with Howe's baby, but lost it. It was becoming clear the effect he had on not only Roden, but the whole congregation. Howe had a captivating way about him with his long curly locks and the way he knew the Bible inside and out. Yet he had an enemy who could see right through him, Lois's son, George. George believed he was the rightful heir of Mount Carmel if Lois died, but felt extremely threatened by Vernon, and with good reason, because when Lois died in 1986, Howe believed he should lead Mount Carmel. But George wasn't backing down, so eventually, Howe and some of his faithful followers made a makeshift compound 100 miles away in Palestine, Texas. For the next year, Howard planned on returning to Mount Carmel for the taking. A bloody shootout would erupt between George and Vernon when he and his men came to claim the property. Vernon and his gang were tried for attempted murder, but every one of them was acquitted. It would actually be George who would end up doing time in a mental institution for murder by insanity. This gave Hal the perfect opportunity to take charge of Mount Carmel once and for all. In 1990, Vernon Howe would legally change his name to David Koresh. He believed that suited him better, and so did his followers. Koresh is Hebrew for Cyrus the Great, a king known for freeing people of Babylon. By doing this, you can see how highly David thought of himself. But for as highly as he thought of himself, his followers thought even more. They were willing to give up modern luxuries to follow Koresh. The residents only had running water in the kitchen and cafeteria. To relieve yourself, you had to do so in the outhouses. The quarters were cramped, yet David asked residents to pay $350 a month if they could spare it. Things at Mount Carmel were strict. You weren't allowed to smoke unless you were David. And there were often times when Koresh would give a sermon for 8 to 12 hours, and during this time, people weren't allowed to eat, drink, and had to stay awake. He began to become fixated on the Book of Revelations. Revelations is the final book of the New Testament that describes the end times and covers the seven seals, which David believed he was going to unlock. He began calling Mount Carmel Ranch Apocalypse and predicted an attack on the group. One day, he had told his followers that every woman in the world belonged to him, regardless if they're married. So he began to father many children by multiple women at the compound. And the men were to comply with this demand, even if they were married, and remain celibate. This caused some people to leave the group, but the majority happily complied. Many men, including Clive Doyle, gave their underage daughters to David. Doyle would give his 14-year-old to Koresh for a wife, and never, even 30 years after the tragedy, feel remorse about it. David's mother would feel sympathy for him, not the girls, saying, "It's not easy on David to have a bunch of wives." In total, Koresh is believed to have fathered 17 children. He began to get paranoid and made some of the single guys at the compound marry his so-called wives for a cover-up. He would even sometimes review the phone bill and ask who people were calling. Then, he began buying and selling guns and ammunition at gun shows. Soon, Mount Carmel Center, this religious compound, had a stockpile of weapons. One of Koresh's right-hand men, Mark Bro, betrayed David when he left the compound and went to the authorities about his former leader. He claimed that the Branch Davidians were converting semi-automatic to automatic weapons, which is illegal. He also informed them of the child and sexual abuse that is taking place there. It appeared that David Koresh had a Judas on his hands. But little did he know, he had others that he needed to be wary of. Making his routine routes in February of 1992, a UPS driver notices a box to the Branch Davidians that is spilled over in his truck. The contents of the package would send shivers up his spine. They were grenades. He wasn't aware at the time that they were only grenade casings being used to be sewn into the men's military fatigue, so he goes to the authorities with the information. It's then taken to the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, who begin investigating the Branch Davidians in May of 1992. During their investigation, they set up undercover agents to live down the road from Mount Carmel. They weren't as undercover as they had hoped, because little did they know the Davidians were on to them. Special agent in charge, Robert Rodriguez, was undercover trying to find evidence of illegal weapons by being friendly and even going to the shooting range with David Koresh. At the same time, Koresh was trying to convert Rodriguez to follow him and the Branch Davidians. 70 miles away from Waco, at the Fort Hood Army Base, the ATF was practicing a raid they were going to do on the compound. They were to surround it, apprehend David Koresh, and search the property for illegal weapons. The date of the raid was set for February 28, 1993. An expose on David Koresh had just been published in the Tribune Herald called The Sinful Messiah, a name he often referred to himself as. In the article, They say that authorities have yet to act on claims of child abuse, sexual abuse, and weapons at the compound. Needless to say, authorities were embarrassed and angry at the publication. They didn't want their plan to unfoil. On the morning of February 28th, a Waco KWTX cameraman asked a mailman for directions to the Mount Carmel compound, but he also warned him to steer clear of the area on his route because there was rumored to be a raid happening that day. The mailman told him where to go and thanked the man for his advice. Both men went on their way, but little did the cameraman know, he had just tipped off the people who were getting raided. The mailman was David Koresh's brother-in-law and fellow Branch Davidian, David Jones. Jones, with his heart racing, makes a mad dash back to the compound to warn the others. At the same time, Koresh was having a conversation with undercover agent Rodriguez, who came to show him the newspaper over David. During their meeting, Koresh is pulled to another room and receives news of the raid. Upon returning, Koresh, who is now certain Rodriguez is undercover, shakes his hand and simply says, "Good luck, Robert." Feeling shaken and worried, Rodriguez runs to his trailer and tells the others to call off the raid. The Davidians know. The element of surprise in which the entire operation is based upon is gone. But it's too late. The plan was on. The raid was taking place. At 9:30 a.m., the ATF surrounded the property. As quickly as they got out of the trailers, a gunfight was underway. Branch Davidians shooting at the ATF shooting back. It looked like a war zone. After 2 hours of battle, 4 ATF agents were dead, as well as 6 Davidians. 32 on both sides would be injured. This isn't what they had planned. They thought they were going to capture David, get the children out safely, and be done. Some agents even brought candy in case the kids were disgruntled. But inside the compound, people refused to leave. Davidian David Thibodeau remembers the ATF agents' faces. They couldn't believe the outcome. Obviously, they couldn't believe they had just lost. And this, in a sense, is true. The ATF had obviously underestimated what they were up against. But most importantly, they had underestimated how loyal Koresh's followers are to him. The ATF was able to communicate to David and other Davidians by phone. On March 2nd, the FBI took control of the operation. They made it a no-fly zone, and they cut off phone connection to anyone except them. No more talking to the press. But Koresh and the FBI would go on to strike a deal on day 3. Koresh would record a sermon, and it would be broadcasted on the radio. In exchange, everyone would surrender. The FBI held up their end of the deal and had a Christian station play his sermon. But when it came time for the Davidians to come out, they didn't. Instead, Koresh said he had received a message from God telling him not to leave. Authorities were livid, but why were they even giving in to Koresh's request? The man obviously wasn't sane. The days began to drag on. The last thing the FBI wanted was another shootout. They decided to bring in their tanks and attempt to show the group how tough they were. They destroyed cars, trucks, and even the kids' toys on the compound. But by March 11th, the FBI asked Washington to approve the use of tear gas on the compound to get Davidians to surrender. The request is denied. Some children and adults have left the compound, but there are still almost 100 people inside. They need more to surrender. They need them all to. So on March 12th, power is cut off to the compound, and conditions quickly grow worse as food is scarce and water is limited. Yet they still stay bunkered inside. The FBI grows irritated and pettily begins playing nonstop sounds on loudspeakers and giant flashing lights so they couldn't sleep or focus inside. This only made the Davidians more defiant and angry. One negotiator truly believes they would have surrendered had the FBI not done that. I'm not so sure, because one Davidian who surrendered said David had total hold over everyone. If David ain't leaving, neither are they. And it didn't appear that he was. So it was time for the FBI to force an ending. After 949 conversations, totaling over 215 hours with the Davidians, one thing was certain. They didn't have an end date in sight, but the FBI did. It was to be April 19th, 1993. On that day, the 51-day-long siege would come to an end. The FBI, approved by Attorney General Janet Reno, would place non-toxic tear gas in the building from tanks and the Davidians would surrender. Once again, the plan went terribly wrong. When they put the tear gas in the building, people began covering with gas masks and started shooting at the tanks. 6 hours went by and no one came out of the building, but suddenly the compound erupted in flames. All but 9 Davidians would die in the fire, including David Koresh. Koresh was found with a bullet hole through his head, but it's still undecided whether it was done by authorities or self-inflicted. In total, 76 would die that day. But how did we end up here? How did the ATF and FBI go so wrong? Why didn't they simply apprehend Koresh when he was out on one of his many jogs or trips into town? Why put so many kids in danger? These are some questions I kept asking myself during my research, and I still cannot find a decent answer. The fires that day were reportedly set by Branch Davidians simultaneously in 3 different places of the compound. But the fires of Waco still haven't gone out over 30 years later. Waco sparked a movement that had people questioning their government. Some believe it's the basis of modern militia movements, such as the Proud Boys and the 3%ers, and I agree with that statement. And in 1995, on the second anniversary of the Waco fire, Timothy McVeigh bombed an Oklahoma City government building. And what I need to point out is he also went and watched the Waco siege standoff in 1993. I cover his story in episode 25. At the end of the day, some blame the government for what happened at Waco. Others blame David Koresh. My goal is to make sure you have the facts to make a decision of your own. For myself, I believe they should have gotten David off the compound and arrested him then. But I also believe David should have complied instead of endangering so many on both sides. What's interesting to me is how some survivors who escaped the flames still to this day believe Koresh is God and what he did was right. Some of those people even got custody of their kids again. The same kids they were willing to offer to David. Some people just never change the views they hold. Thank you so much for going on this journey of the Waco siege with me. The story almost seems too crazy to be true, too tragic to be true. These are the situations we must live and learn from, yet we've all learned different things. Ask 2 people who were alive during Waco whose fault it is, and I bet you get different answers. No one can agree on who to blame because it just went so wrong on every part. But one thing we can't do is change what happened. These are facts. If you have any questions on the episode, want to talk history, or have any episode suggestions, email me at thechroniclesoftimepodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate and review the show, and to tell your friends about it as well. Check out my social media pages for updates on the show and more content. I have a new blog on my website, www.thechroniclesoftimepodcast.com. And a new YouTube video will be out within the next week. I'm your host, Rachel Payton. Thank you so much for listening to the Chronicles of Time.